shut down major cities and operations in China sporadically and disrupt businesses in a world increasingly accepting of COVID-19 as a reality to live with. In fact, China's civil aviation predicts that by the end of next year, the country's air traffic, while double the current figures, will still be just 15% of what it used to be before COVID. The policy's toll on people's mental health, though, may have been the biggest cost of China's success in containing the virus. Repeated lockdowns has resulted in the Chinese youth developing gaming addictions, sleep abnormalities, and a reluctance to go outside. Of course, COVID wasn't the only thing President Xi discussed in his address. He called for accelerating the country's military development while China already spends the second largest military budget in the world after the US. The military plan aims to improve China's ballistic missile capabilities, develop various aircraft carriers, and establish overseas outposts. Xi can lay out such military development plans because he doesn't just hold the title of President of People's Republic of China or the title of Secretary General of the CCP. He is also Chairman of the Central Military Commission. Taiwan's relations with China as well as the US have been clearly defined in the One China policy. It is the diplomatic acknowledgement by the US that there is only one Chinese government and that the US can have no formal ties with the island of Taiwan, but rather with the Chinese government. The policy has a long history dating as far back as 1949 after the end of the Chinese Civil War. But it was in 1979 when, under Jimmy Carter's presidency, the US finally established formal diplomatic ties with Beijing and thus severed ties with Taiwan and closed its embassy in Taipei. But in that very same year, the US also passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which meant that it would support the island's ability to defend itself by supplying it with arms. The US has always maintained strong informal ties with Taiwan. The One China policy was undermined much further during Trump's presidency, and not just because of former president's inflammatory remarks about China.
And then we had the horrible plague come in from China. Boy, oh boy, what they cost the world.
It was because after decades, Tsai Ing-wen, president of Taiwan, spoke to a U.S. president, breaking diplomatic protocol. Sino-US relations have only gone downhill from there. The biggest offense in the eyes of China happened when US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island in August in a move that infuriated China. Since then, Beijing's resolve to reunify with Taiwan has only gotten stronger. Xi Jinping has time and again rejected any form of separatism, as well as interference in the island's affairs, as it considers Taiwan a part of its territory. Xi's call for accelerated military development could hint at his impatience over US meddling and his increasing resolve over following through with his reunification plans with Taiwan.
We gather at a vital time for the United Kingdom. These are stormy days.
The UK Prime Minister Liz Truss may not have known what she walked into when she took over the premiership just months ago from the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. An economy battered by COVID-19, then the Ukraine conflict, which impacted the UK's economy negatively. With runaway inflation and a cost of living crisis, she had to come up with a plan. That plan was presented by the finance minister, or exchequer at the time, Kwasi Kwarteng. But she could never have anticipated the firestorm and crisis that erupted afterwards. After several U-turns of whether or not she would go through with what was called a mini-budget plan, she was forced to finally make amendments to the plan. And what many have called a move to save herself and her job, she fired the now former finance minister, Kwasi Kwarteng.
I met the former chancellor earlier today. I was incredibly sorry to lose him.
She replaced him with Jeremy Hunt, a former health secretary and foreign secretary, who was announced as Kwarteng's successor.
It was a mistake to cut the top rate of tax at a period when we're asking everyone to make sacrifices. And it was a mistake to fly blind and not to back up the economic plans that were announced with an independent forecast from the Office for Budget Responsibility.
Truss scrapped the pledge to reverse predecessor Boris Johnson's hike of corporation tax from 19% to 25%, a decision estimated to restore around £18 billion, or $20.1 billion, to the UK Treasury's coffers by 2026. Her explanation for scrapping the plan: markets were not ready for it.
But it is clear that parts of our mini-budget went further and faster than markets were expecting. So the way we are delivering our mission right now has to change.
The Institute of Fiscal Studies had doubts on this so-called mini-budget, basically calling into question where the money was going to come from. It said that unfunded tax cuts meant that the UK will need £60 billion in spending cuts. It also said that this would leave ministers making serious reductions in public services. This puts into question the claims made by the former Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng.
The government has been clear that protecting consumers is our primary focus and shapes our entire approach to this issue.
As for the 2.5% targeted growth, nonsense. Said the UK will struggle to grow at more than 0.8% on average over the next 5 years. In other words, the £45 billion cost of the mini-budget would wipe out any financial space left to the Chancellor by his predecessor, swelling Britain's debt as the share of national income for at least the next 5 years. The turmoil that exists in the UK mirrors what is happening across many European countries. Economies are under strain and people are suffering as a result. Wrong fiscal policies can be the reason for this suffering, but political directives also impact people's lives and well-being. That couldn't be more evident on the EU, led by the US, to continue the war on Russia, even if it meant that their own citizens would suffer as a result. But cracks are emerging following the US lead. For example, France has joined Germany in accusing the US of using Ukraine war to overcharge for gas. After the Ukraine conflict, the EU was forced to start importing LNG from the US, as well as other countries. But the US's share had increased sharply, from 28 to 45%. On the other hand, deliveries from Russia dropped by 75%. But this statement from the French economy minister, Bruno Le Maire, shows that France may have caught on to the US role in the Ukraine conflict. Le Maire recently told French MPs that the conflict in Ukraine must not result in the US economic domination and a weakened Europe. This is while the economy minister, Robert Habeck from Germany, accused LNG exporters, including the US, of charging too much for gas at the time when Europe's biggest economy is struggling to balance its energy mix without Russian supplies, and when German companies are closing down factories due to high gas costs. Electricity cuts in the UK and emergency gas rationing in Germany are just a couple of signs of how European leaders are sacrificing their country in order to defeat Russia and the less threat that they face from it. As for their economies, Europe has already slipped into a recession, and there are no signs that it can devise a plan that would lower energy costs to pre-Ukraine conflict levels in order to save their economies.
Whether signed in the White House or overseen by a U.S. president or secretary of state, the United States has almost always had a role in any and all negotiations between Palestinian and Israeli sides. Looking at some of the more important instances of these talks, one can think of the first Oslo Accord in 1993 that was signed in Washington in the presence of then-U.S. President Bill Clinton. The 1999 Sharm el-Sheikh Memorandum that was signed in Egypt was also overseen by the U.S. through Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State of the Clinton administration. The unsuccessful Camp David summits in the year 2000 was overseen directly by Bill Clinton himself. Following the unsuccessful peace talks, Clinton would make another effort at influencing the Israeli-Palestinian relations through the aptly named Clinton parameters, showing the extent of his and U.S. involvement in the talks. Sometimes this influence even meant that the fate of Palestine would be discussed without the participation of any Palestinian representative, as was the case in the Camp David agreements in 1978, which was signed by Egyptian President, Israeli Prime Minister, and then U.S. President Jimmy Carter, without even an Arabic version of the documents. These showed the never-wavering U.S. Pledge of Allegiance to Israel, a pledge that will always protect Israeli interests, which would automatically go against Palestinian interests. Among the most important of these interests is a trinity of inalienable rights defined by the Palestine National Council in 1974, which consists of Palestinians' right to self-determination, an independent state, and most importantly, right of return. The most recent example of neglecting these rights occurred in 2020. During Trump's tenure, the deal of the century was presented, which many later called the flop of the century. The Trump peace plan was titled Peace to Prosperity, a vision to improve the lives of the Palestinian and Israeli people. But it was far from that. The plan had been delayed by 2 years and previously rejected by the Palestinians, who were not invited to the meeting. The plan never materialized, however, since, again, it was not representative of the Palestinians' rights on major core issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The first time Israel attempted to make the smallest bit of compromise was at the Camp David summit in 2000. Israel said it would be willing to allow 100,000 Palestinian refugees back to their homeland, while the millions of others had to be resettled wherever they were at the time. Also, Yasser Arafat, then chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, would have to forego the idea of right of return completely from then on. Similar ludicrous proposals that were rejected by Arafat were all proposed, with the U.S. being on board with these proposals. The U.S. involvement in the so-called peace talks have time and again shown Palestinians and their officials that the U.S. is not to be trusted as a neutral party. On the sidelines of the sixth summit of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia and Kazakhstan, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas had a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. In it, he expressed that he is happy with Russia's position on Palestine. He also said that he would only accept U.S. involvement in the conflict resolution process if other parties of the Quartet on the Middle East were present. The Middle East Quartet, established in Madrid in 2002, is a foursome of nations and international and supranational entities involved in mediating the Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations. Its members are the United Nations, the United States, the European Union, and Russia. Palestine's hand is now one of unity, since the Palestinian factions have all established peace amongst themselves, including Hamas and Fatah. Palestinian factions signed reconciliation agreements in Algeria. Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups agreed to hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year after the successful talks held in Algiers. Meanwhile, when it comes to peace talks between Israel and Palestine, Abbas has stressed that Washington should not be given free hand to act alone in resolving the decades-long Palestine-Israeli conflict.
The rising rivalries between the U.S. and China are set to dominate the coming years in the 21st century. That is because the U.S. has unveiled this long-delayed national security strategy, where China is named as the most consequential geopolitical challenge for the regime in Washington. That means that Washington is prioritizing winning over China, as Beijing is seen as the only global rival to the U.S. Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, said, "The People's Republic of China harbors the intention and increasingly the capacity to reshape the international order in favor of one that tilts the global playing field to its benefit." The U.S. strategy further insists that China represents the most consequential challenge to the global order. It also says the U.S. must win the economic arms race with the superpower if it hopes to retain its global influence. The strategy has warned that China's rapid advances in technology is aimed at molding the world order. The strategy is in line with the rhetoric pursued by the Biden administration and its predecessor. Biden officials have accused Russia and China of looking to change the so-called rules-based order. The term has come to be seen as a synonym for Washington-led world order. The Biden administration has entangled itself in a number of global crises, including the war in Ukraine. The Washington regime encouraged the war in Ukraine by sending more weapons into the conflict zone. Washington is using the crisis to contain Russia. And by encouraging its allies to sever their energy ties with Moscow, Washington is trying to push European countries into its own sphere of influence. Furthermore, Washington is stoking tensions in the East Asia region by strengthening its ties with the Chinese Taipei. Back in August 2022, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, drawing an angry reaction from China. Beijing has warned that it will not tolerate Washington's meddlesome interference in its own affairs. But Washington's increasingly belligerent behavior in Europe and East Asia has pushed Russia and China closer together. They have forged closer ties in a variety of fields, including energy, business, and defense areas. Furthermore, both Moscow and Beijing are key members of the BRICS groups of countries and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Two bodies are playing key roles in shifting the Western-led balance toward a multipolar world. Russia and China have also forged closer ties with countries like Iran and India, which are emerging powers in the shifting geostrategic relations worldwide. It is now widely believed that Washington's ambitions to still lead the world is facing tough challenges. It appears that the regime in Washington has no longer the capability that it once possessed to dictate its hegemony.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The consequences of Europe's submission to the US dictates are being felt deeply these days as the European households are grappling with soaring energy prices and high inflation rates. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote, Berlin must act quickly and drastically to avoid hospital closures, the health minister has warned. Many hospitals in Germany may be forced into bankruptcy due to soaring energy prices and inflation unless the federal government comes up with some form of assistance, Health Minister Karl Lauterbach said recently. He said, if we do not react quickly and really drastically, there will be closures. The German Hospital Federation complained last week that the funding gap could add up to around 15 billion euros in 2022 and 2023, but the health minister brushed aside that estimate, saying that no one can predict how expensive electricity will be next year. The Federation, however, said that extra energy costs account for just about a third of that sum, while the rest of it was non-refinanced increases in material costs due to soaring inflation. The health chief is set to meet Finance Minister Christian Lindner to discuss potential forms of assistance the government can provide, but has for now ruled out creating a specialized federal fund to help keep the healthcare facilities afloat. The hospitals are in a very special situation, he said, adding, but we cannot create separate special funds for each sphere. Annual inflation in Germany continues to rise by double digits, accelerating to 10.9% in September. Finalized data from the Federal Statistical Office showed recently. The inflation rate has reached an all-time high since German reunification, the Stasi President George Thiel said, citing enormous price rises for energy products, as well as food costs, as the main reasons for the high inflation. Leading German economists have recently warned that skyrocketing gas prices could push the EU's largest economy into recession. They forecast that Germany will be among the countries worst affected by the global economic slowdown next year. The EU is currently struggling with a severe energy crisis, with gas prices hitting record levels, driving up overall inflation. Russia once covered over 40% of the EU's gas needs prior to the start of its military operation in Ukraine and the ensuing sanctions. Supplies have dropped dramatically this year, exacerbating the energy crisis as the bloc seeks to reduce its dependence on Russian energy and punish Moscow. German energy giant EnBW AG announced recently that gas prices for households will rise again by an average 38% starting on December 1st. The announcement comes around 3 months after the previous increase went into effect. Also, Anadolu website reported the incidence of bankruptcy claims filed by companies and partnerships in Germany have increased by 34% to 762 year-on-year in September, exceeding forecast, the Economic Research Institute IWH said recently. The institute has predicted a rise of 25% a month ago for September, it added. Stephen Muller, a director at the institute, said there will be visible increases in bankruptcies in the coming month. For October, IWH's leading indicators signal for a one-third more bankruptcies annually. While in November, even a 40% level can be exceeded, he noted. In addition to the seriously deteriorating economic situation, bankruptcies stemmed from a sharp increase in prices of important factors of production, Mueller said. While the European Central Bank's interest rate hikes raised the financing costs for companies, the increased average wage per hour from 10.45 euros to 12 euros as of October added new costs to firms' budgets. The rises in energy prices related to the ongoing Russia-Ukraine crisis have also adversely affected the cost. Also, AFP reported massive crowds of protesters took to the streets of Paris recently to voice discontent over the rising cost of living. It comes as the country's largest trade union continues a refinery strike that has closed gas stations across the country. The protest was organized by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former presidential candidate and leader of the left-wing France Unbound party. A number of other leftist parties and organizations participated, with some calling on President Emmanuel Macron to take a stronger action against climate change. However, economic concerns are first and foremost on the minds of protesters. It's not the march of Mr. Melanchon, the LFI leader told France 3 TV, adding, it's a march of the people who are hungry, who are cold, and who want to be better paid. The rise in prices is unbearable, LFI deputy Manon Aubry told AFP, adding, it is the greatest loss of purchasing power in 40 years. France's inflation rate currently stands at 6%, while almost all of the country's industrial sectors have recorded a drop in activity due to rising energy costs, largely a result of the EU's sanctioning of Russian fossil fuels following the launch of Moscow's special operation in Ukraine. With household energy bills soaring, firewood is once again in demand in France, and power outages have been forecast. Clashes between far-left radicals, a regular fixture at French protests, and police officers were reported, with riot police firing tear gas to subdue the black-clad rioters. Amid the protests, France's CGT trade union is continuing strikes at oil refineries, demanding pay rises for workers. The strikes, which have been ongoing for 3 weeks, have caused shortages and rationing at gas stations. GCT said recently that it rejected a pay offer from oil giant Total Energies.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. Some people feel happy when they pray alone. Instead of 17 rak'ah a day, they offer 51 rak'at a day, not to mention other recommended prayers. Someone tells them people are leaving the religion in droves. This does not concern them. As Saadi says, they pull their own rug back from the wave. They say, it's hard enough to save ourselves, let alone anyone else. Some people think this way, but the kind of action that is a mark of faith is not this. Anyone who prays well but prays by themselves without any concern for the prayers of others, this is not correct. It is not, as we said, complete. What is the mark of true faith? Maintaining the prayer. Maintaining it by praying in a community, by making everyone worshippers, although not necessarily in the sense that everyone worships together. I want you to think beyond the words. I want you to think more broadly. Words are too small to express this. This doesn't mean that we make the person who doesn't pray say his prayers. It means making a community which prays, a community which is always mindful of Allah and is always following the path of Allah. A community which says, you alone we worship and your aid alone we seek. The Quran, Surah 1, verse 5.
دنیای اسلام
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
community that only worships and serves Allah, and a community that relies on no one except Allah. A prayerful community means one which in its daily life distances itself from the leaders of corruption, those upon whom is Allah's wrath, مَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ, and those who follow corruption, those who are astray, ضَالِّين, the Quran Surah 1 verse 7. This is what prayer means. If someone tries to make other people prayerful in this sense, this is a mission done in the service of the truth, for the sake of removing corruption, for the sake of removing us and them, for the sake of the unity of a society and the unity of all human beings. This is what it means to maintain the prayer. In other words, you do something so that everyone, five times every day, will repeat the words, "You alone we worship, and your aid alone we seek. Allah, we only serve you. We only bend to you and to no one else." Five times every day, they will disassociate from those who have incurred your wrath, مَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ, and those who are astray, ضَالِّين, from the leaders of corruption and the followers of corruption.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment. In the limelight.
The Zionist regime, in a blatant and barbaric move, has authorized its military to kill Palestinians with drones in the West Bank. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The website of New Arab wrote in this regard, "The Israeli regime army chief of staff decision in September to allow the use of armed drones in targeted killings in the occupied West Bank has raised concerns about the humanitarian and legal implications of such a policy. The Israeli media had reported that the Israeli army was preparing to implement the use of drones in military raids. Such incursions, numbering more than 2,200 so far in 2022, have in recent months included the targeted killings of Palestinians, especially in Nablus and Jenin. These raids are generally carried out by the Zionist regime's special forces and are frequently confronted by Palestinians, turning into hours-long gun battles. However, the reported green light by the Zionist regime chief of staff Aviv Kochavi to carry out targeted killings using armed drones could have profound legal and human rights consequences on an entirely different level. The Zionist regime began the practice of targeted killings through air strikes in the West Bank during the Second Intifada. The first aerial assassination in the West Bank by the Zionist regime was the killing of Hussein Abayat, a Fatah Palestinian leader in Beit Lahm in November 2000. He was killed when the Zionist regime Apache helicopters launched missiles at a van he was traveling in. Besides Abayat, two Palestinian civilians aged around 50 were killed and six other civilians were wounded in the incident. Despite civilian casualties, the Zionist regime Supreme Court ruled in 2006 in favor of allowing targeted killings in all their forms. In the following years, the tactic was used mostly in the Gaza Strip, especially through airstrikes, often causing heavy civilian casualties. Tahsin Alian, a Palestinian legal expert, told The New Arab, "This is the first concern when it comes to drone killings, that they will most probably cause civilian casualties. Apache helicopters during the Second Intifada were manned by pilots and still they killed innocent people. Almost with each strike. Drones are machines, and it is proven by experience in other countries that they kill innocent victims more often than not." According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism Statistics, between 8,858 and 16,901 people have been killed in some 14,040 U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, Afghanistan and Somalia since 2010. Between 910 and 2,200 of the victims were civilians, and 283 to 554 were children. But aside from civilian casualties, the use of drones for targeted killings raises a more fundamental concern. According to the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, U.S. drone warfare often violates international law, such as strict rules and basic human rights, namely the right to life and physical integrity, by attacking individuals without sufficiently determining their status. According to the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, the targeted assassination of Palestinians also classifies as an extrajudicial killing. The extrajudicial killing of Palestinians is already a current concern, pointed out Tahsin Alian, adding, "They will most probably increase with the introduction of drones due to eased Israeli rules of engagement and the increased capacity of killing anyone, anywhere by drones." Last week, following a briefing to the Israeli media, a Zionist army spokesperson told Israeli journalists that drone attacks would be used only in case of an immediate need to eliminate a threat and not as a policy of resuming assassinations. However, the Zionist regime's army's green light of drone killings comes in the midst of an ongoing escalation in the West Bank, where Israeli regime forces have already killed 165 Palestinians during military raids into Palestinian towns and cities, including several targeted killings of Palestinians in northern West Bank. Mohammad Rai, a human rights activist based in Nablus, told The New Arab, "People are worried about the possible use of drones in killings because they are sure that civilian casualties will increase. For the last 2 weeks, Israeli drones haven't left the skies of Nablus, and although they are most probably not armed drones, their sound makes everybody nervous," he said, adding, "My family and I, as well as our neighbors, feel already threatened by Israeli raids, and drones make it even more difficult to live our daily lives, thinking that they might soon begin to fire. I personally hope that the Israeli occupation doesn't begin to kill with drones, because we all know that it was targeted killings that exacerbated the situation during the Second Intifada and prolonged the violence. Osama Hanini, a younger engineer in Ramallah, told the New Arab, adding, "The current situation, which is already loose and uncertain, would become even more violent and complicated." Tahsin Alian remarked, "There is no guarantee that the number of killings would not increase after the introduction of drones. Taking into account that the Israeli definition of an immediate threat is loose and not objective, the use of drone technology would most probably result in more human rights violations, unlawful killings, and civilian casualties."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
After weeks of economic and political turmoil, an early announcement by the UK's new finance minister aimed at calming the nerves at home and abroad.
Although the Prime Minister and I are both committed to cutting corporation tax, on Friday she listened to concerns about the mini-budget and confirmed we will not proceed with the cut to corporation tax announced.
And with that, Jeremy Hunt reversed most of an economic package announced by his predecessor, Kwasi Kwarteng, just weeks ago, including a planned cut to income tax.
It made no sense economically, it made no sense politically, and basically the markets couldn't make any sense of it either. So basically, you've ended up wasting a lot of time and energy reversing a stupid policy that was put in the first place. Simple as that.
But not everything is being reversed. The government is still going to end the cap on bankers' bonuses, meaning bankers will be able to take home more than double their fixed salary when the change is made. And then there is the cap on household energy bills, Liz Truss's most popular policy, that was supposed to be in place for 2 years. It'll now be reviewed in April next year. Much of the economic and political turbulence in the UK is blamed on the war in Ukraine and unpredictable global market forces. Many experts say there is another important culprit.
Ultimately, a lot of this nonsense and the idiocy of Boris Johnson, the idiocy of Liz Truss, actually, its roots are in Brexit. Because what has Brexit done to the British economy? It's basically knocked 4 to 5% off the GDP. That's led to a loss of tax revenues for the government. It's led to problems for business because they haven't got the supply of labour that they need. All right. And it's basically acted and a huge waste of money, of course, on customs officials and this and that and the bureaucracy for business.
Liz Truss's premiership has been nothing less than a roller coaster. Her decisions have given the opposition Labour Party a comfortable lead in opinion polls and badly damaged her credibility with her own party.
With the new Chancellor ripping up her economic plan, the Prime Minister now has to regain support of the MPs. But with the amount of plotting that's going on against her, whether or not she can do that is anyone's guess. Saeed Pereza, London.
The streets of Rubeznoy in northern Donbass resemble an apocalypse. There was a major battle here between Russian and Ukrainian forces. It's now under Russian control, and the threat of incoming artillery now comes from the Ukrainian side.
Now, the Russians have been in control of this town for a couple of months now, but we've heard of a school that was hit very recently by Ukrainian artillery, so we're going to go there now and have a look.
School number 10. Locals say it was American HIMAR missiles that are responsible for these scenes. A decision will have to be made on whether to tear down the school or to attempt to repair the damage.
It was shelled on the 23rd of September. There was no military there. I live in the house in front of it, and I never saw any military. I'm the head of the educational department. They were preparing that school for the start of educational process, and we're cleaning it in preparation. Half of the school is destroyed.
We were planning to open three schools, but one school, number 10, wasn't able to open because it was hit by HIMARS. Luckily, it was at night and there was nobody there. It was during the referendum. It was hit on purpose, and it was hit directly because there's still some people in this town who are pro-Ukrainian, so they tell them where to strike.
While I've reported for many schools in Donbass that have been directly targeted by Ukraine, it's not clear whether this was hit due to its association with the recent referendum on joining Russia. Across the playground, a block of flats. One of the missiles landed outside this old woman's apartment. She calls the Ukrainians who did this cursed fascists, then bursts into tears. She was wounded in the blast and only recently returned from hospital. Inside, her kitchen has been blown out.
I'm nearly 70 and I'm afraid. Everybody is leaving. But where do we leave to? When the shell landed, I went out into the kitchen and looked. So I crawled under the bed. Everything is crumbling down. I woke up at night when a piece of wallpaper fell and covered me.
The American HIMAR missile system is amongst the most advanced pieces of military hardware in the world. Each missile costs $150,000. In Rebeznoy, they are being used to blow up schools and terrorize old women. Johnny Miller, Rebeznoy.
The Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a signed the last list of prisoners with Saudi Arabia, under which inmates will be exchanged between Sana'a and Riyadh. Head of the committee, Abdul Qadir al-Murtada, said the database that was an obstacle to the implementation of the agreement has been corrected.
The four Geneva Conventions, especially the Third Convention on the Protection of Prisoners, mention the rules for the protection of prisoners as a humanitarian issue, and no party should link it to political matters. Unfortunately, countries on the Saudi-led coalition are working in line with the agenda of America and Israel, so it made no move until receiving American directives, and this has always been a hurdle to solving the rest of the issues.
Al-Murtada said a visit by the Sana'a delegation to Saudi prisons was successful, as the Yemeni prisoners were reassured that the swap deal would move forward. He hoped that the reciprocal visits will be a first step towards settling the humanitarian issue of the prisoner exchange.
The results of the recent visits were positive. The lists were corrected for both parties, and the names that will be exchanged between us and Saudi Arabia in the coming days have been signed. We in the National Committee for Prisoners Affairs consider the prisoners issue as a humanitarian one. We should not be linked to military or political matters. If all parties are serious enough to resolve this issue, it will open up prospects for setting other issues as well.
Recently, a Saudi technical delegation visited Sana'a, while another from the Prisoners Affairs Committee of Sana'a entered Riyadh to verify the names of prisoners of both parties.
The warring sides in Yemen have taken a new step toward peace by visiting each other for the first time. Observers say if the prisoner swap deal moves forward, it could help end the war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muslim religious and community leaders from a variety of sects gathered in London on Sunday for the 24th International Islamic Unity Conference. The annual event, held at the Islamic Centre of England, aims to promote religious unity, combat sectarianism, and defend Islamic values.
This event coincides with a similar Islamic Unity Conference held annually inside Iran. The Islamic Republic has come under a sustained attack in recent weeks by Western groups advocating for regime change following the unfortunate death of Iranian woman Mahsa Amini.
Many groups are involved in backing the anti-Iran riots, most notably Western-based Iranian dissidents and supporters of the MKO terrorist group. Although they are divided on doctrine, one factor unites them: Islamophobia.
They are hijacking maybe an agenda to portray this clash of civilization, and they are portraying this narrow-minded, neoconservative narrative that Muslims are barbaric, Muslims are narrow-minded, and Muslims need to be liberated. And this was the type of language that was used at the dawn of the second and the first Gulf Wars, of trying to say, we're here to liberate Muslims, we're here to liberate their countries, and this is very dangerous.
These are actual people who have an agenda to make Muslims and Islam enemy number one across the world. So whether it's targeting the Islamic government and the Velayat-e Faqih system in Iran, or whether it's attacking a woman with hijab on the streets of East London, actually the phenomena is rooted in the same thing. It's an actual organized attack on Muslims.
The anti-Iran riots have expanded to include an international campaign condemning Islam and Islamic concepts, such as the hijab. It's now up to Muslim leadership to find ways of combating the tide of anti-Muslim abuse. Initiatives such as this intend to inspire a fight back. Robert Carter, London.
On Saturday, anti-government rallies and protests were held in the Italian capital. In the morning, high school students took to the streets of Rome to stage a protest that converged on the education ministry. Pupils were demanding more investment in education after what they called two decades of budget cuts and the country recording the highest school dropout levels in the EU. They sent out a warning to the next government, saying Italian schools must be upgraded to be of quality standards.
We are still wondering why the government hasn't scrapped a 2015 school reform. We demand the next executive to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school and to declare a state of emergency for Italy's school buildings.
Later on Saturday, hundreds of people held a demonstration not far from the government building. The initiative was organized by a recently formed anti-system movement called Sovereign and Popular Italy. At the demonstration, people urged the next executive to do more to shield families and companies from surging energy prices and to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and find ways to promote peace internationally.
We want to stress how the lies told by the mainstream media on the conflict in Ukraine have brainwashed the Italian people. It's NATO who declared war on Russia using Ukraine as a tool. An end must be put on this historical phase made of imperialistic violence and the longing for expansion.
Our movement demands the next government to pay in full for people's exorbitant bills and to review the country's foreign policy that is literally plunging our economy into chaos. But I am afraid the next executive will stick to the same line adopted by the outgoing Draghi government.
Italy is in the process to install a new government as the Mario Draghi government collapsed in July, leading to snap elections. The far-right formation Brothers of Italy has emerged as the party garnering the most support from Italians in the vote last month, and its leader Giorgia Meloni is slated to become Italy's next prime minister. More protests were held in Italy over the past days. Earlier this week, operations were suspended for 24 hours at Genoa Airport following a demonstration called by the Ansaldo Energy plant's employees against plans to close the factory. Also, the Italy's largest union, CGL, staged a large demonstration in Rome about a week ago, demanding more protection for workers. A hot autumn of protests and strikes seemed to have just started in the country. Max Civili, Rome.
In what's being called a disaster for the ruling Democratic Party, inflation has reached a 40-year high in the final official reading before next month's midterm legislative elections. The data is even worse than it appears because the government excludes food and petrol from the official inflation rate. The record high is being driven by increases in other necessities such as lodging, medical care, and mass transportation.
You know, at this point everything's expensive, but we have to buy what we have to buy. So at this point we're going to pay for everything. It's not very fun, but we do it.
No one likes the higher prices, including myself, so we're just trying to get through it until we can make enough money to be able to afford everything.
With prices rising 8.2% and wages increasing just 4.9%, Economists say the average American effectively lost almost an entire day's pay last month, and that's using the official inflation rate. Even though almost every economic indicator is negative, the nation's bankers seem intent on restricting borrowing just when businesses are pulling back new job offers in record numbers and credit card debt is at a record high. The situation has already deteriorated into liberalism's theoretically unsolvable dilemma, stagflation, which is recession plus inflation. The right-wing economic policies may also produce political stagnation. The likely Republican takeover of the House of Representatives and possibly the Senate would hobble President Joe Biden's ability to get any major legislation passed for the next 2 years. The nation's bankers are trying to stop price increases by destroying the demand for goods and services. The reduced demand should lower prices eventually, but the policy rules out wage increases for workers and keeps corporate profits high. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has held a big protest in the Gaza Strip to condemn the surge of Israeli attacks in Al-Quds and on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. People thronged the streets of the blockaded territory following the Friday prayer to take part in the event. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowed to stand with Al-Quds. In recent days, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds and asserted that armed resistance is the key to reaching freedom.
We condemn the Zionists' provocations in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we salute the freedom fighters in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Today, we're entering a new era where armed resistance against Zionist occupiers is the strategic choice, not only in Gaza, but also in the occupied West Bank, Al-Quds, and everywhere in Palestine.
Protesters also expressed their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli aggression and attacks. Palestinians in Gaza have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds. Occupied by Israeli forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for justice and freedom.
Al-Quds is the core of our struggle against the Zionist enemy, and we are willing to die in order to protect it. Zionist forces and settlers are skirting Al-Aqsa, and we must escalate the resistance against the Zionist occupiers.
This is while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of a future Palestinian state. Palestinians here are calling for stepping up all forms of resistance against Israeli plots over Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Less than 4 weeks before the United States midterm legislative elections, the committee investigating the election-related protests on January 6, 2021, announced that they will subpoena ex-President Donald Trump to testify. However, most analysts believe Trump will not ultimately testify, and his written response to the panel was noncommittal. Trump has reportedly been telling aides he favors testifying as long as it would be done in a live public hearing, but the commission isn't likely to agree to that. Almost 2 years after the presidential election, the country appears to be as divided as ever, with Trump supporters calling the subpoena an October surprise meant to influence the midterms, while anti-Trump partisans say the subpoena proves that not even an ex-president is above the law. The January 6th committee has been alternatively branded as a necessary defense of American-style democracy or as a staged show trial. What appears certain, however, is that it has had seemingly no effect on the American public. In poll numbers, which are virtually unchanged despite nearly 2 years of intense mainstream media focus on the committee, 35% of America still calls the events of January 6th a legitimate protest, while 50% of the country still calls it an insurrection. Over 60% of Republicans still believe the 2020 election was illegitimate. In 2017, polls showed that over 60% of Democrats still believed the 2016 election was illegitimate. America's political division did not begin on January 6, 2021, and it does not appear that the committee will fully unite the nation by voting day on November 8th. The news of the